This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There's a scene in Walter Bennett's new novel that will send chills down your spine. It's a warm night in 1962 in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. A group of young white men pile into a rickety Ford and ride through the black part of town. Their boyish horsing around turns sinister when they decide it'd be a good idea to hit black pedestrians with eggs and hurl racial slurs. The scene is based on an experience from Walter Bennett's adolescence, and it still sends chills down his spine. Walter Bennett's new novel, Leaving Tuscaloosa, brings alive the tensions of the American South during the final days of Jim Crow. Walter himself left Tuscaloosa for college, Vietnam, and law school. He had a long career as a civil rights attorney and as a juvenile court judge in Charlotte. He retired recently from teaching law at UNC to write this novel, and Walter Bennett is my guest on the program today. Welcome. So good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Let's talk about that scene. It is somewhat autobiographical. That something like that did happen in your life.
It did. I think I was around 16 years old, cruising with buddies. I don't even remember their names. And that's what we were about, although I don't think it was clear to me when we started that's what it was going to be about. And we were going through a black section of town, and I saw this guy walking on the side of the road, a black guy, tall, sort of, you know, relaxed, walking down the side of the road on a probably Friday, Saturday night. I remember that, seeing him. And I don't remember much else, except I know whoever threw the egg hit him. And what I vividly remember is looking through the rear window of the car. I was in the back seat. And seeing him chasing us. I mean, flat out chasing us. You know, arms pumping, hands pumping, as if he really thought he could catch us. But it was all adrenaline, and I began to perceive anger, shame, whatever. Very human qualities. And it was one of those moments where, you know, the turret of your brain clicks a few notches and you see that there is a part of the world that you have not seen before or perceived. And, you know, at some point along the line, you begin to see that there may be another 358 degrees that you don't know. But that was sort of a beginning a moment there that was fairly pivotal.
Is that a scene that you had revisited often since it had occurred?
Yes, and I think more often recently, and by that I mean when I began this novel, because that scene kept coming back as a good beginning for a novel. And and so then it began to turn over more and more. And I'm reading a wonderful book now by William Maxwell where he talks about how you treat memories like that. And it's like you begin to tell a story. It's a limited memory anyway. I don't remember all of it. But you begin to tell a story in your mind that goes over and over. And through your own emotions or whatever, it starts to change. And then you start to look for the meaning in it. And I think that's the process.
It's interesting. The title is Leaving Tuscaloosa, and yet you essentially had to revisit and return to Tuscaloosa, I would think, to write the novel.
That's correct, and did so physically and mentally. And, of course, the landscape that I create is fictionalized, and the landscape that I knew there no longer exists physically.
So let's tell us about the protagonist, Rishbo Branscombe. Tell us about him. I don't know how to get the name, by the way, is the pronunciation.
Rishbu was a friend of my wife and her sister. I don't know who he was or anything. The name stuck, and I thought it'd be a good name for a protagonist.
Tell us about him. He's white.
He's white. He's 17. He's an angry young man. He's, his future is not bright. He's not headed to college like a lot of his friends are. He's marriage. He's got all sorts of issues with his father. He's got issues with his father-in-law and some very complex issues with his mother.
And so, A.C. Waits, tell us about him.
A.C. is probably a couple of years older than Rishbu. He is a sensitive guy. He's an artist in the making, And he has his own pressures and issues that he has to deal with, primarily from his community, the expectations they have.
He's African American.
Correct, yeah. To be a leader of the African American community there, and from his mentor, who is his preacher and the current spiritual leader of that community.
And what kind of leader is critical, because his brother has become a kind of leader in that community, or has taken a role.
That's great. Yeah.
So, and of course, place plays an important part. And maybe at that, I can ask you to read from the opening of your novel to give us a sense of the place that we're talking about.
Okay. Thank you. It's this will be the first chapter. It's entitled The Town. The town sits atop bluffs that drop to the river in broken ridges of sweet gum and pine. Indian villages once flourished along these banks, Choctaw, Chickasaw, and Creek, long since erased by the picks and spades of white men, red-faced Scotch-Irish farmers, pencil-fingered planters, hard-jawed traffickers in iron and coal, and African slaves. They hacked it, trampled it, tilled it, and mined it until all traces of the ancient life were gone, save the occasional arrowhead turned by a plow, and native spirits whispering at nightfall along the river's shoals and eddies. Now it is an ordinary town. Streets run straight, buildings are glassed and square, stoplights change from red to green. Away from the business district and old neighborhoods, University Avenue winds along the bluff parallel to the river. It dips past old mansions, beer parlors, and pool halls, and rises toward the vast lawns and blocky buildings of the university. The White Column President's Mansion and the Denny Chimes have bonged the 6 o'clock hour. Fraternity houses feed KAs, Phi Delts, and SAEs, bound for dorms and sorority houses for dates with tri-delts, KDs, and sweethearts from high school. Nearby spread the working-class neighborhoods, plumbers, painters, salesmen, and teachers wash off the week in the bathtubs and shower stalls of the shotgun houses crowding the willow oaks and asphalt grid between the university and the white high school on 15th Street, home of the Tuscaloosa chieftains. The menfolk will help with the dishes, feed the German shepherd out back, settle in for an evening of Penny Ante poker, Crazy Eights or TV, Andy Griffith, Bonanza, Friday night fights at 10. The women will bathe the kids, catch a smoke on the porch, talk to neighbors. These are the white people. They get what they expect out of life. They do not hear time's freight train clacking down the track.
Walter Bennett reading from his novel Leaving Tuscaloosa. You know, it's interesting when you create a place like this and you have to go back in your memory. Your characters are human beings. They have lots of options. And in this book, they do. There's some transgression that takes place. The white young man, Richebeau, does make friends with AC, and he crosses that line. Place is really fixed in a way, and it's in some ways immutable, the thing that they can't change, the life they were born into. What does that do for you when you have to go back and remember after you have changed so much over these years and create this fixed place of your childhood and of the setting of this book?
That's a very interesting question. I've dwelt on it a lot lately. I think that I had to move beyond all of that to get an understanding of my own relation to it, get a view of what went on back there, not only with me, but in my community, in order to go back and try to reconstruct what it was like then. And, you know, when you're 16, 17 years old, you are largely unaware, or I was largely unaware, I should say, of what was going on around me. I thought I was, but I wasn't. And I don't think until I could gain the consciousness that I needed, then I could go back there and begin to understand it.
It's interesting because you could have done a memoir. You chose to write a novel. This is not the story. Leaving Tuscaloosa is not your story. It is a novel based on an episode in your life. Why did you choose to do that? Why did you choose to create a novel, a fictionalized version of this?
Well, a memoir would have been a lot less interesting, I expect. All of these things that occurred in there did not happen to me. There were no 36 hours of, this takes place over 36 hours of that kind of racial turmoil in Tuscaloosa, although, of course, there were a lot of things going on there. But I think that by fictionalizing and using the imagination, you can take those incidents or scenes from your memory and childhood and enhance them in such a way as to bring the meaning to them that hopefully your consciousness and your conscience has achieved over the time.
We'll find out how that conscience and consciousness has evolved over time as we continue our conversation today with Walter Bennett. New book, Leaving Tuscaloosa, just ahead, how Walter's road out of Tuscaloosa led through Vietnam and back to North Carolina. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Walter Bennett, his new novel called Leaving Tuscaloosa. He recently retired from teaching law at UNC Chapel Hill. Before that, a civil rights attorney and a judge, now a writer. Let's talk about your real biography, the things that informed this novel in some ways. Some of your most eye-opening youthful experiences, I understand, came from your grandfather's tobacco farm in Virginia. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's correct. As I have explained to others, as I've tried to explain this novel, in Tuscaloosa was a severely segregated society. I didn't really know black people there other than ones who, you know, came to friends' houses, maids, and that sort of thing. And so I didn't have a real insight into the black community. On my grandfather's farm, I worked in fields with black people all the time. And we became friends. They spoke openly about themselves. So did I. I visited in their homes, not as a guest, but to take them home. And I saw how they lived. And I think that at least on a couple occasions, I saw how they felt about their condition. These were rural folks, and they were impoverished. I mean, no other way to look at it. And they were really part of, they were a holdover from slavery. They were tenants and laborers. So got a good view of their lives.
And this might have been before the egging incident when.
Oh, yeah.
So you're beginning, so this conscious, so this is beginning to click into place, this 360-degree turn that you talk about, happens slowly over time. There's a whole group of people that are living differently than me, and then you see the emotion and anger and begin to empathize when you throw the egg. What? And you said also that the Civil War, in a lot of ways, was alive in Virginia. Was that not true in Alabama, the way that it was sort of palpable?
Not as much, because my great-grandfather and four of his brothers were in Pickett's Charge, and my grandfather and my uncles were imbued with all the lore of the Lost Cause. And, I mean, that was talked about as if it were current, almost, and as if it weren't over. That was, you know. and so, yeah, I became very caught up in that. And I think that informed a lot of the attitude toward blacks and African-American people. They were viewed as partially a part of the old system.
Right, which still had some hope, some way of sort of retrieving or hanging on to that. Did it strike you as odd as a young man? Again, we're talking about a coming of age, a coming of consciousness by turns, slowly by slowly. And I wonder if you thought at the time, gee, this is odd. This all finished up, you know, nearly a century ago in the 40s and 50s. Why are they still talking about it this way? Or was it the ground you walked on? Did you not notice?
Well, I had an advantage in that my father was a college professor, of course, who'd come out of that background and educated himself through Duke and had a PhD in political science. And my mother also was a college professor. And they were liberal by those standards. So I'd heard the other side of the story. I think I reflected on that and saw that it was wrong. But I didn't know what to do about it and didn't try.
You say your parents were both academics. Your mother taught at an HBCU. Is that right?
She taught at Stillman College, which was at that time an entirely black college in Tuscaloosa. So I heard what she said about her life there when she came home.
You've said that AC, the African-American protagonist in your novel, was inspired in some ways by a friendship that you had in Tuscaloosa.
Very vaguely. I imagine 4 years old, certainly no more than five. We lived in a section of Tuscaloosa, which was right downtown, but next to us was a lumber yard. Across the lumber yard were the railroad tracks, and across the railroad tracks was the black section. And a young African-American kid who was older than I, for some reason, came across the lumber yard and began to play with me. And I have very vague memories of that, but very tender memories of that. And that appears to some degree in the novel because the two kids, AC and Rishbu, are former friends. I think that probably, maybe that planted a seed that came out.
And, of course, their friendship in the novel is prohibited and restricted at some point, as it would have been, I suspect, those days in the South.
That's right. Well, and I don't know whether it would have been prohibited and restricted entirely, but the system itself would not have brought them together. So the system was an oppressive system in both directions.
You went to school and eventually left Tuscaloosa, and you joined the ROTC. So tell us about that and the beginning of your military career.
Well, it was the traditional Southern approach to the military, the assumption that that was part of your life and a part of growing up. I think a lot of that came out of the Second World War, but it also was a holdover from this Southern cause business. And so I went to ROTC, came out of college with a rank of second lieutenant and an MOS as an artillery officer, even though I was an English major. I've never quite understood where that came from, and went to Vietnam.
You went to Vietnam, and there again you had a kind of conscientious experience. Your sense of the war and military glory, it seems, changed once you got there.
Oh, yes. And, I was not particularly conscious then of what was going on in the world and, what was happening in terms of our relation with other countries and so forth. But you didn't have to be there too long if you were thinking and watching to know that we had no business there whatsoever. And I came to that conviction, and my attitude toward all of it changed.
It's interesting because I think for those of us raised in the North, the idea that there was, and are of a certain age, right, we're coming of age at that time, a sense that everyone was engaged or a lot of young people were engaged in that same struggle. And yet here in the South, it was perceived entirely differently, and that wasn't quite the culture down here.
I think that's right. There were plenty of people who avoided it and didn't want to go and protested and thought it was wrong to begin with. But I think there was a much stronger feeling in the South that it was an obligation that needed to be met.
You were there and you spent a couple of weeks in a foxhole. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was an elaborate foxhole in a sense. It was not, just a hole in the ground. We had bunks and so forth, but we were dug in. This was on top of a big jut of rock called the Razorback, which was out on the way to Quezon. I was in the Army, but I was assigned to the Marines. The Marines had spent many lives taking that rock from the Vietnamese, and it was used as an outpost. And my sergeant, I was what was called a forward observer then. You would go out and spot rounds for artillery and look for targets. And he and I were assigned to a Marine squad that went up there to man that outpost. And he and I wound up in the, if you call it a foxhole, I guess it was really, together. And he was an African-American guy from Kansas City, very different culture from what I'd seen. A terrific guy, and sort of much more into being Army than I was, And we spent 2 weeks there together. It was an interesting 2 weeks. I remember one incident where, you know, you think of things to talk about when you're there day after day. And so we got off on music, and I was trying to impress him with all I knew about African-American singers and so forth. And who did I like? Well, you know, B.B. King, Otis Redding, Muddy Waters, da-da-da-da-da. And I said, well, you know, Sergeant Williams, you know, who you like? He said Sinatra. And suddenly it was another one of those moments where, you know, the things start to click. It's like, oh, yeah, I mean, there's a whole different culture out there that is nothing like I've seen before.
So we'll talk about the changes and your direction once you got back. But I'm wondering, at this point or up until now, what did you think you'd be doing? You said you'd already majored in English. What were your thoughts about your future going into the Army?
I think I had decided by then I was going to be a college professor, because in another foxhole later, I remember filling out application to the University of North Carolina graduate school in English. And you know, that's where I went after I mustered out of the Army.
So you're thinking about teaching English, getting into the academy, and what did you do when you left?
I got out of the Army and immediately went into graduate school with the idea of getting a PhD, and found that, well, two things. One was that the job market at that time for English PhDs and a lot of the humanities was the bottom was dropping out.
Early 70s now we're talking about?
That would have been late 60s, yeah.
Okay.
Around 68, 69.
Okay.
And also, I loved English as an undergraduate, but graduate school was something of a grind. It wasn't a, sort of a joyful exercise. And, I mean, you were studying for a career. And I thought, well, as long as it's going to be a grind, I've always had some interest in the law, so why not give that a try?
And you did.
I did, yeah.
Went to law school. What were your intentions? What kind of law did you think you were going to practice?
Well, I made a good friend in graduate school at Carolina who was a lawyer. And he was a civil rights lawyer and had practiced civil rights law and more or less still was as he was a graduate student there. I admired him a lot, and I thought, if I'm going to be a lawyer, why not do this? I mean, do good works, you know, take on the kind of law that I believe in. And so that was my idea when I left for law school.
And it was, and I'm wondering now, what's the blend here or the percentage of the impetus, all of the social consciousness now that's beginning to rise and become much more acute, it seems to me, in your mind, particularly about race. Was that a driving factor in this decision? I mean, again, you're looking at making a living. That's the other thing you have to think about when you choose a school.
That's right, and going into civil rights law was not the best way to do that.
And if you think the life as an English professor is right, not looking
right.
Bright.
Right. Well, another thing that was, of course, going on when I was in graduate school at Carolina is that the protests against the war and some civil rights protests on race and the women's movement was beginning then, and the environmental movement for that, that was hot. And so that certainly influenced me as well. But I'm sure I made the connection between being a civil rights lawyer and my growing consciousness on race, particularly in the South.
So tell us about your first job as an attorney.
I went to work with a civil rights firm in Charlotte, which was called Casey and Daly. It was sort of the other civil rights firm in Charlotte, the famous one, was the Chambers firm, which did a lot of wonderful cases, including the Charlotte, called the Charlotte busing case. But we represented people on their First Amendment rights. We represented people who had been assaulted, abused by the police. We sued people to get government jobs back, which they'd been denied. So it was an active civil rights practice. And again, not a very lucrative one.
Clearly you've done several things since. Why did you leave that practice?
I had an opportunity to become a judge, and I think that just by my nature, the adversarial process was tough on me. I had to really posture a lot and really take an attitude that wasn't very real.
That's interesting, because it would seem to me that you would be committed to the cause, that you would feel, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, righteous about what it is you're trying to achieve.
That's right. But righteousness about what you're trying to achieve without the right temperament does not necessarily make a good lawyer.
So off to the courts, and you became a juvenile court judge.
Well, I became a district court judge, and I took special training to allow me to hold juvenile court.
Why?
Because I thought I'd had some experience in juvenile court, but I thought in juvenile court there was real hope. I mean, there were resources there. There were social workers. And the chance of someone actually benefiting from the court experience was much higher there. And so that's basically.
And the someone, of course, are those young people who find themselves often in pretty difficult circumstances.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, how did it work out? It seems it could be awfully frustrating as well, because you're looking at those circumstances every day of your life.
That's right. It's frustrating, and it was emotionally draining. And I think that, you know, I and my fellow judges did good work in there. You could see it. But on the other hand, there were cases that were simply hopeless. And those are the ones that at night keep you awake and, you know, make you wonder, why am I doing this if something this important is not working, at least in this particular situation?
Is there a particular case that continues to haunt you?
There are a number, but the ones, it's really a group of cases. They were designated Willie M. Children because of a lawsuit brought in federal court for a juvenile name whose name, of course, was not given publicly, but was designated as Willie M. Sued the state of North Carolina for not providing services. These were severely disturbed children who had capacity to do violent things, harm other people, harm themselves. And the state simply was not providing resources for them. And almost all of them were impoverished, and their families were impoverished. So that lawsuit in federal court brought some resources to bear. And those were tough cases because you were dealing with kids who really were damaged.
And doing damage. I mean, the fact is the system is structured in a way that if we don't get help to them quickly, the amount of damage that we're going to be blaming the victim very quickly. They're going to be punished for the abuse that they've endured in their young lives.
Correct. And they're going to be adults soon, and they're going to be doing even more damage. Yeah. So that's right.
Did you feel like those cases that the kids were helped, that they were rescued in a sense from the worst of it?
I think that some of them were. And certainly in the short term, most of them were at least prevented at that point from harming themselves and harming other people, because there were ways to either put them in situations where they were carefully supervised or get them counseling and so forth.
Are there cases, or is there a case that stands out as a real victory in your life as a juvenile judge?
I don't know that one stands out. There were plenty that made me walk out of there feeling that I had done some good.
And what happens in that case? How does that happen?
Well, a case that you've seen maybe three or four times. One thing about juvenile court is kids keep coming back and they keep getting reported on. And, you know, a social worker and a lawyer stand up and say, this kid has really made great progress. And we think that the court no longer needs to give supervision, and off they go. And if they don't show up in adult court in a couple of years when you're over there, you hope that that things have worked well.
That's a great way to be fired, isn't it? We don't need you anymore, Judge. Right. He's on his own. Right. My guest this hour is Walter Bennett. His new novel called Leaving Tuscaloosa. He's been a civil rights lawyer, a judge, and a professor, now a writer. Our conversation continues after a short break on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest is Walter Bennett. He grew up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, went to college in Virginia, fought in Vietnam, became a civil rights attorney, went on to become a juvenile court judge in Charlotte, a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill, and has written a novel called Leaving Tuscaloosa. We left you in juvenile court. You went from there. You went back into civil rights law then, right?
Briefly. That's right. Got what is known as a master's in law in order to sort of segue into teaching.
I'm wondering about this, how things may have changed in that brief return to civil rights law. You know, historians will talk about the long fight, and here you are sort of in the late 60s practicing law. Now it's the 80s, and you're back in the struggle. Had the struggle changed, do you think, the civil rights struggle?
Well, it had to some degree. In the sense that the civil rights acts that were passed in the 60s had really come to fruition then, and people were bringing large lawsuits for race and sex discrimination against large companies, corporations, and governments. So a lot of the civil rights cases then were huge cases where you brought class actions against whoever.
This is the thing I think people forget about, the power of government and the power of all of us to change. You know, so often the discourse is this, some part of why can't we all live together? And then in that discourse is, well, the politicians keep us divided. And I find that a troubling discourse in that it leaves out the potential for change, that at any point along the way, people can get engaged and make huge changes and things really are different as a result. People act and changes take place. And I think your novel, in a way, points to some of that the characters in this book had a lot of options. They had friendships that could have happened or not. They could have lived with the system and said, we can't be friends, but they transgressed. They had to overcome a lot of tensions and anxieties about each other and did, and in some ways didn't. I wonder if that's a frustration or anything that you've given any thought to, the fact that we don't give enough credit to the power of collective will, that governments, people, when they act in concert, make real change.
Yes, I think so. And I guess that's certainly one of the underlying themes of the novel. The idea that these two guys, and I guess particularly Richebeau, the white guy, because he's the real racist in here, would be able to make that transition is an effort to show the kind of humanity I think you're talking about, that people can reach out. They can look into themselves, find their own humanity, and then begin to see the humanity in other people.
And that racism isn't a form of monster DNA that is somehow only in the bodies of other beings. That we all have to examine our own privilege and understand how it promotes racism, how it promotes our privilege is kept at the expense of those who are less privileged. That's his consciousness. That's how his consciousness is raised and how the change happens. This individual sees who he is in the grand picture.
I think that's right. And recalls the when they were kids, the friendship that had that was not. You know, when you're that age, when you're that young, you don't understand that your society is split and there's not supposed to be any of the coming together that you're talking about. The natural goodness is there. Mm. It's the strictures of society and the hard messages and the hatred is what it is,
right,
that comes out that, sort of puts the slams the door.
But you don't have to live with that. That through art, through contemplation, through recollection and narrative, one can actually change the story, change the outcome.
That's right.
AC is an artist himself. AC, the African American character here, who is a sculptor. Why did you make him an artist? What was it about that you thought would be interesting or useful for this character?
Well, I wanted both of these characters to transcend the limitations on their lives. And I have friends, African-American friends, who have worked under the burden of this expectations of the community. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it is a burden. And to transcend that, I wanted AC to have something that really drove him and called him to forsake that role as savior of his community and to find himself and to give himself to whatever that was. And art seemed to be something that would be a very strong pull and was also in some ways an antithesis of that other role, because as many writers and artists will tell you, you have to be selfish to some degree to be an artist. I mean, you really do have to reject some of the other pressures and give yourself permission to be what you want to be. And that was the big struggle for him.
Selfish in some ways, but in other ways, self-sacrificing in that, the ideas, the images, the structures that you held in your mind this morning, you're willing to give up, smash, and destroy in the name of this new vision that you may have had.
That's right. Or let them be destroyed or survive on their own.
Right. Yeah. And this contrasts, of course, with AC's brother, who does take a much more militant, direct role in becoming a savior for his community.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I want to get back to now your biography and your story, because you wrote in the 80s a book of nonfiction called The Lawyer's Myth. And in a sense, I think it looks at the ideals of the legal profession, which was a profession that was sort of on the ropes in the 80s, the butt of many, many jokes, not so perhaps a couple decades earlier.
I'm not as optimistic as you that has changed. But the book was actually written, I think it came out in 2000, 2001, I can't remember for sure now, but it was based on or got started on oral histories that I and students at UNC took of lawyers and judges. And I began for the first time in my life to really see the power of narrative, the life stories of these lawyers sitting there and telling these students meant so much to students, law students, because they hadn't heard how lawyers really live. They went to law school, they were taught the law, and mostly by law professors, many of whom had not practiced before. And I was teaching legal ethics, and I realized that standing up there at a lectern, lecturing them about ethics, when I wasn't at that time practicing and having to deal with these very tough issues, wasn't really getting anywhere. And hearing it from the real-life lawyer who's out there dealing with it every day really delivered a message. And seeing their lives play out really made a real difference in how they perceive their profession.
And, of course, storytelling is essential to the legal profession. I mean, that's what it's all about, whether you're in court or elsewhere, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the stories clients bring into your office, the stories you hear from other lawyers, the trial itself is a story, unfolding story.
So it's interesting. We talked earlier about why not a memoir? Why try to capture the truth in this genre called fiction? And in a way, in the courtroom, that's what happens. There is a body of facts. Something happened. Somebody did it. But, you know, both sides have a way of spinning the tale. And if you're a jury, you can be awfully confused by those facts and the way the narrative is strung.
Absolutely. And it's been said many times that the last place you want to go to find real truth is in a courtroom. But you're right. And the story comes out. It's almost like what I was saying earlier about a memory. Looking back on it, you see, you know, vague configurations of it, and those are presented in a courtroom, and you hope that the jury sorts all that out and comes up with something close to reality or a truth that works.
A kind of a justice. Yeah. Well, so that said, can I get you to read again from your book, Leaving Tuscaloosa? Walter Bennett is my guest. That particular scene that is both for you memory and now part of your fiction, your novel.
Okay, this proceeds with the white kids in the car, and at this point, the spiritual leader of the black community, John Folsom Grice, is walking home from a meeting that he's had with Rosemont Green, the local liquor store owner who is also involved in civil rights work. The Ford growls along not more than 15 miles an hour. A thumping comes to Richebeau's chest. The sounds and smells of the night disappear. The man is 50 feet ahead, walking in the same direction they are headed. Dark suspenders crisscross the white shirt on his oak-like back, long forearms swaying from the rolled shirt sleeves. He is bent slightly forward, as if lost in thought. Yet there is an ease about him that Richebeau gets in his own body when he's walking loose and free. He can almost feel the man's movement in himself, an elasticity between them. Richebeau wrestles his upper body out of the window, plants his butt on the sill, and clamps his left hand around the doorpost. His other hand reaches back for the egg, his palm itching to feel the hard roundness of a leather-stitched baseball. But it is not a baseball. It's got that smooth, oblong shape to it, that feeling of suspended interior weight, like something alive, like the yellow yolks that jiggle every morning when his mama slips the sunny side ups from the spatula onto his plate. He grinds his butt deeper into the sill for balance and curls his hand with the egg up and behind him across the roof. He cocks his throwing arm, rests his elbow on the roof. Ronnie, one of the other people in the car, wraps his arms tighter around Richebeau's legs. The engine turns slowly, each cylinder recording its pistons rise and fall. The man's pace slows down. His head dips slightly. His hand rises to his hat brim. He will turn in the next second. An acknowledgement, a quiet good evening. It crosses Richebeau's mind that this man is a leader of some kind, preacher, funeral home director. Those are the big shots in the colored community, at least so he's heard. Something in the proud straight back, the slow walk, certain walk. The wrist that holds the egg flinches and stops. Richebeau readjusts his fingertips. The disappointing lightness of the thing, the thin, delicate shell. His second flinch does not stop. A snake striking from the car roof in a great swoop across his body. The egg leaves the fingers in wobbly flight. Not the whizzing trajectory of its fastball. No perfect oval, no white blur narrowing to a perfect point. But it hits. Pow! Just behind the ear. A perfect throw. A sound so loud that for a second, Richebeau wonders if he's cracked the man's skull. Pieces of shell explode. The slimy drip begins. Richebeau pulls his arm backward for balance. The roof gutter of the car digs his elbow, giving him a numb, funny bone feeling. The tall man grabs a spot behind his head. His hat and glasses fall as he drops to his knees, then to all fours. He begins to feel around for them in the dirt and grass. Richebeau has the crazy idea that if he could just leap from the car, hand them to the man, and jump back in, they could get out of there before the man turns his head.
Walter Bennett, reading from his novel, Leaving Tuscaloosa, and my guest this hour on The State of Things. So I wonder what it's like for you to read that passage, which you must have read now. You've been on tour a little bit. You wrote it. You had to spend time crafting it, perhaps editing it, and yet it was this experience that you've gone over. When you read that now, what happens to you?
Well, I guess you're right. I've read it so many times, but there's still a great deal of feeling and emotion in that. And, of course, readers at this point don't know what comes later, but there is a tremendous amount of feeling for both Richebeau, who has gotten himself into real trouble and doesn't know how, and John Folsom Grice, the black minister, who a moment in his past is resurrected here where he was really shamed, and it's happening once again, and suddenly he has to react to it.
There is a lot of drama and mayhem that occurs in these 36 hours in the book that I assume didn't really happen in real time in Tuscaloosa. When did those ideas, these plot points that are quite dramatic in this novel, come to you? Were they of a piece, or did you work on them kind of one at a time?
I was discussing the other night with other writers, some of them very good, about how they construct a novel, and it's done so many different ways. I wish I were one of those folks who constructed the novel, knew where it was going, put piece to piece together, and filled it in to the end. This novel evolved, and things just happened. And I knew I was going to try to do it in 36 hours, but I didn't know what was going to happen. And characters walked into it, like Rosemont Green, the liquor house owner, came out of nowhere and started talking, and he almost took over. I call this sort of these magical moments where things happen, plot occurs, scenes occur, characters start to speak. So that's how it works with me.
Was this cathartic for you, writing this book?
I didn't realize it, I don't think, until after I had finished it and began to talk about it with folks like you. But yes, I think it was cathartic. And someone asked, is it an atonement? Well, I certainly didn't start to write it that way, but I think it is.
And what are you working on now?
I'm working on another novel, and also involves issues of race. It's set in the 19th century and is a woman who is partially African-American, mainly white in ancestry. Looking back over her life, she was raised white in a very wealthy white family and was sold into slavery during the war.
When you finish, will you come back?
I'll be happy to come back if I can get it finished.
Well, now you have an incentive, and your publishers heard that, so they'll be cracking the whip.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Walter Bennett, great to talk with you. Walter Bennett, the author of the novel Leaving Tuscaloosa, going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh Sunday, October 21st at 3 o'clock. And is there a website that we can go to check it all out?
Yes. It's called LeavingTuscaloosa.com.
LeavingTuscaloosa.com. Going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music on October 21st. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.